At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello and welcome back to the Hindu Studies channel of New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. You can find out about my background at rajbalkaran.com. More importantly, I have the pleasure today of speaking with Dr. Borayin Larios, who is assistant professor at the Institute for South Asian, Tibetan, and Buddhist Studies in Vienna. Hello, Borayin. How are you?
Hello, Raj. I'm very well. Thank you. And thank you for the invitation as well.
My pleasure. Our pleasure here. We're speaking to him about an open access book that you can all access by clicking the attached link to this post. The title of his publication is Embodying the Vedas, Traditional Vedic Schools of Contemporary Maharashtra. So this is obviously a fascinating read for anyone interested in Hindu studies or Indian thought and culture. Arguably, the Vedas, or this idea of something being Vedic or not, is one of the most pervasive themes of what we may call Hinduism today. And we'll certainly dig into that. But why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about how this book project came about for you?
Right. So, it's a project that took quite a while to see the light of the day. I started actually with my master thesis on one particular Vedic school, looking at one particular Vedic school. And the reason why I was interested in that is because I came to hear Vedic recitation for the first time sometime in my teens. And that really kind of blew my mind, literally. I was really impressed by these Brahmin priests reciting these mantras at such a, unison it was just a really fascinating experience to hear how the pronunciation was perfect and they were singing in a group. And the reason why I was really fascinated because it was the feat of memory. I could not believe that someone could recite from memory for so long, right? So that was the thing that sort of triggered me to look more into the Vedic tradition. And so I first did my MA trying to study one of these schools, so to speak, anthropologically. And then I realized that there was not so much literature on the subject at that time. So I sort of thought that would be a great dissertation project and decided to look deeper into these schools in Maharashtra by expanding the network, so to speak. I had so far looked at one school. But I heard that there were many others, so I wanted to also look at these other schools and also see the differences between the different schools. So that was the main motivation there.
And would you say then that's the primary aim or theme of the book, to look at these schools and survey their similarities, differences, and the extent to which they preserve tradition?
Yes, definitely. I mean, that's sort of, so to speak, one of the core aims of the book, is to look at, you know, how is this transmission of knowledge that we've perhaps read in books still alive today, right? And how the ideal that we read from, say, Sanskrit literature, how does that look like in contemporary India? And well, in Maharashtra in particular. So it's a book about the oral transmission of the Vedic tradition, of the Vedas as bodies of sound. And it's also about the Brahmins themselves. So it's an ethnography in the sense that it looks at not just as these schools as institutions, but it also tries to look at Brahmins themselves and what they are trying to do in contemporary India.
So why don't you tell us, for the purposes of your book and your research, what you mean and what you refer to as the Brahmins? Because some of our podcasts, specifically the last one we did on the snake and the mongoose, really problematized that idea, at least in ancient India. So for the sake of our listeners, when you say the Brahmins, what do you mean?
Right, that's a tricky question somehow. I mean, I also try to problematize this in my own book by complexifying how Brahmins themselves have portrayed themselves throughout history, so to speak, right? And so how do they construct their identity, which is also an important part of the book, especially at the end. But what I mean by Brahmins is traditional families who were born into the Brahmin caste, all right? They have a Brahmin birth. And of course, I don't mean all the Brahmins in Maharashtra, but I mean those Brahmins who consider themselves orthodox and actually learn the Vedic recitation. Yes, I mean Vaidikas in that sense. So Brahmins who learn to memorize the Vedic texts in particular. But I do problematize the notion of the Brahmin and who I mean by Brahmins in the book itself. But I hope I sort of pointed to an answer there.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Now, would you say then that the Brahmins that you research, that their primary function is to actually preserve these Vedic utterances?
Yes. That's the whole aim of these schools, actually. So it's interesting because very often when I used to talk to people about my project, they would think that in these schools, children would learn Sanskrit and how to, you know, interpret the Vedic scriptures. But the truth is, these schools are similar in that regard to, for example, madrasas, where children are basically trained to reproduce the sounds of the Veda, and not so much the content or the semantic content of those mantras and those hymns. So I think it was Fritz Stahl who once said they're like walking tape recorders. So the main aim of this traditional Brahmins is to learn to memorize and reproduce these texts and to pronounce them accurately and to also learn to employ them in ritual. Those are the two main aims. And the exegesis, so to speak, of the Vedic mantras is sort of a a secondary or an additional branch of study that does not necessarily belong to these schools.
So this is a profound feature of what we call Hinduism, and definitely worth discussing, particularly given your background and research in this book. As you mentioned, I believe in your introduction, when we refer to Hinduism as the oldest living tradition, really what we mean is Vedic religion. And the oldest living tradition, really what we mean is this presumably unbroken lineage of oral transmission from teacher to student of the Vedic revelation. You make an important distinction in your book between the Shastrika and the Vaidika, and just so our audience is clear, it's the Shastrika whose job it is to understand the exegesis of what is meant by the utterance, and there's an entire class of Brahmins whose sole function it is to preserve the precise utterance for the sake of ritual effect. Now, maybe you can tell us more about why on earth a culture would invest so much in the preservation of the utterance and not necessarily the meaning thereof.
Right. So one very important concept in the Vedic tradition is that sound itself, right, is the meaning, right? It is what's worth preserving. It is what's powerful, right? And especially if you look at certain corpuses, as already Fritzschall had shown, they don't necessarily mean anything as in semantic content. For example, if you look at the Samavedic songs, right, where you have utterances that don't have any semantic meaning, right? So there, the power is in the sound itself, and therefore the sound needs to be protected and be transmitted as accurately as possible.
When you say power, you don't mean power to hold or produce meaning. So what kind of power do you mean in this context?
Well, it's a rather complex notion, but the first thing is this Vedic recitation, right? Is meant to preserve the order of the universe, Ruta, right? And so with the ritual and the recitation of these mantras, basically the whole universe is being preserved from allowing the sun to rise to the rain to fall and so on and so forth. So it's a kind of a participation in this cosmic cycle, right? And for Brahmins, it's part of their paying their debt, their runa, their debt to the ancestors. And to keeping on this universe functioning, basically. It's considered to recite, right? This swadhyaya, this recitation of sacred text, came to be considered Brahma yajna, so the sacrifice of and to Brahman, right? And there's also for those of you who are more interested in the topic, there's a French scholar, Charles Malamud, who wrote this book, Cooking the World or Cooking the Universe, where he explains how Swadhyaya, this recitation, is part of the balance of the universe, basically.
How did you end up in Maharashtra, and why? How did that become a focus of the schools you looked at? Incidentally, I was there in 2012 for Sanskrit training at the American Institute of Indian Studies in Pune. So I am somewhat familiar with the lay of the land there, but tell us, why Maharashtra?
Why Maharashtra? It's almost a mere coincidence. The first school I was invited to observe in Satara for my master's thesis is based in Maharashtra. And basically, thanks to their invitation and generosity, I was able to stay in their school, and then from there create this network of other schools that I could visit. So it was almost coincidental. And then I also saw that there was not so much work being done on Maharashtra in terms of the Vedic tradition. So it was a win-win situation, in the sense that had I gone to, for example, Kerala to visit the Nambudiri Brahmins, as Stahl and others have done, then I could not have compared that to the classical, so to speak, works that have been written on the subject. Whereas in Maharashtra, there was nothing on Vedic education, at least that I could find. So it was kind of virgin territory for me as well. And yes, over the years, Maharashtra has sort of stayed my field of work. And it's a place I enjoy very much. I mean, as you know, Pune is one of the more welcoming cities in India, and comfortable to stay. And so that was another plus.
And of course, its patron deity is none other than Ganapati Ganesha himself, Lord of Wisdom. So perhaps it was a wise choice to do your research there. What was the process like in terms of your encounters with these students and these Vedic priests? Tell us a little bit about barriers, if there were any, or the idea of preservation or secrecy or openness, and tell us about your experience researching.
Right. So I have a part of my introduction is sort of explaining my experience as an ethnographer and a participant in these schools, and how I, on the one hand, received enormous generosity and welcoming to these schools. But on many other occasions, it was a territory difficult to navigate, A, because I was a foreigner, and therefore, according to the traditional notions, I was not necessarily considered to be pure. Some of these Brahmin schools have very strict rules of ritual purity, and therefore, a foreigner or just anyone who's not a Brahmin is considered a potential danger, at least in ritually speaking, to these schools. So it was not necessarily always easy to approach the schools or to get access to them. But on the other hand, there was an enormous curiosity and generosity of heart, especially from the students, but also from many teachers. So it was really quite an experience for me to live among these children who, frankly speaking, lead completely different lives than we do, right? In the sense of like the childhoods that that we have in Western countries, or even in, say, modern India, versus the lifestyle that they lead. It was a humbling experience, and it was also fascinating to watch. In terms of like communication, it was not always easy because there was a language barrier. I attempted learning Marathi, but I must confess I wasn't very successful. And so communication usually happened either in Hindi or English or a mix thereof, sometimes in Sanskrit for those children or teachers who actually spoke Sanskrit. But it was challenging, to have those conversations sometimes. So in many cases I had to rely on a translator who could help me out. But many times I was just also not necessarily conducting interviews, but just sitting in the classes, observing, the daily schedule, observing their relationship basically between student and teacher. And I got a lot, I learned a lot just from sitting around and observing. So yes, I guess that would be an answer.
So there's a lot of interesting themes there. I'll ask you a couple of questions and then you can answer. You can tackle them as you wish. But first, a comment. It seems that perhaps you were met with the hospitality that is accorded to a guest, that is proper to a guest in traditional Indian culture. One of the dictums being that the guest, much like the mother and the father and the guru, is like a deity, a divinity coming into your home. While you were met with the hospitality accorded to the guest, certainly that's not tantamount to the access accorded to an initiate. This idea of purity and pollution and access, one question that comes to mind is, certainly as an outsider, a foreigner, so to speak, you wouldn't have the requisite ritual purity in the eyes of this tradition. Now, is that to say that all Brahmins would have the purity to access these teachings?
No, I guess, I mean, it depends on what level, right? So they're different, like ritual purity is of course always context dependent, and there are always sorts of ways of negotiating that. But just to give you an example, right? With food, which is usually one of the ways in which you get to learn about ritual purity. So in many of these schools, when I was visiting there, I was offered food, I would either be served first and kind of in an isolated place, or I would sometimes be served with the students, with the Brahmin students, or sometimes I would be asked to go and have food somewhere else, right? So because food is such a central aspect in which purity and hierarchies are kind of negotiated. I had very different experiences depending on which school I was, or even whether other visitors were coming or not. And to speak about the hospitality, yes, totally, I agree. I mean, that was certainly one part of like being welcomed, and Atithi Devo Bhava, the guest is like God. But on the other hand, if I try to stay longer or just be part of their daily life, their daily schedule, then of course other things came up, right? So for example, where would I sleep? Where would I, take a shower? Things like that, right? So it was interesting on that level because I learned a lot about, what does it mean to negotiate that purity, and for Brahmins themselves, being in the modern world, so to speak, there are a lot of tensions regarding what is acceptable and what's not acceptable or negotiable, and there's a whole chapter on this as well in the book, on ritual purity and, for example, how they should dress, or whether they're allowed to have ice cream or not, or watch a movie, you know, things like that.
So tell us about, tell our listeners about the requirements of such a one, of an initiate, of these children who are born in the modern world, but are also in a very, very different space. Tell us about what it takes to be a member of this lineal transmission.
Well, of course, the first requirement is that you come from a Brahmin family, right? So not everyone gets to go to a Vedic school. At least the schools, that I surveyed, except for one, and maybe we can talk about it later. But so the first rule is to come from a Brahmin family, from a Brahmin background. Ideally, you should go to learn your own Veda. So each Brahmin family is born into a particular Veda and a particular branch of the Veda, so a shaka. And so ideally, you would go and learn your own shaka, right? So if you're born in Taittiriya Brahmani, Taittiriya Jayurveda family, you would go and learn Taittiriya Jayurveda, right? But nowadays, because there are less and less students available on, and also less and less schools, you know, students would sometimes go and learn another Veda, depending on what's available, or another shaka, maybe the same Veda, but another shaka. There is flexibility around that. But then the other major requirement is, of course, the Upanayana, which is the initiation ceremony, or the threat, sacred threat in investiture, which basically is a ritual that traditionally was meant for Brahmins to start their education. It was their initiation into the Veda, right? So it was when they first heard the Gayatri Mantra whispered into their ear, and then they could basically start to learn the Vedic canon from that moment onwards. So that is still a very important component of Brahmins who want to study there. They need to have had their sacred threat ceremony performed. And sometimes they do that even at the school, if they're sent there young and too young and have not yet had the ceremony. Sometimes the schools themselves perform it for them, for the families. And then the other requirement is basically to live with the teacher in the school, and dedicating your life, basically, or at least a period of your life, to learning the Vedas. And that of course varies according to different factors, but perhaps the most important would be your own capability of how good your memory is, basically, and how fast can you learn, and be the curriculum of your school. So depending on which shaka you are learning, and depending what your guru says, you would then sort of learn. The I would say the minimum requirement would be to learn the Samhita, but of course many schools teach more than that, right? And so the curriculum is sort of open upwards. There is, you can basically be a student for the rest of your days if you want to. But there are also sort of minimal requirements to at least get the title of Vedamurti, which is the title given in Maharashtra for one who, commonly given in Maharashtra for one who finishes basically the shaka training or the basic corpus of recitation, which is an interesting term as well, and that's where I got the idea for the title of the book, which is the embodiment of the Veda, right?
So how long would a student on average typically take to attain this level of mastery of Veda Murti?
Well, it's hard to tell. I mean, I have a few figures in the book, depending on the shaka and the curriculum. I would say on average, if they actually complete the curriculum, is about between, I would say, 7 and 12 years. But of course, as I said, you can prolong that. And a lot also stop before. So there are different reasons for interrupting one's studies, but usually it is an economic one. So it's often tied to, as soon as they can make money, they're taken out of the school, or they themselves want to start earning money and give up their studies. So it has also led to
And so for such a one that makes it to the Veda Murti status, what is the fate of such a one? Do they then go on to professionally perform rituals?
Right. So there are different career options, so to speak, after one finishes one's basic training. So one very, beloved career option is become an astrologer, a jyotishi, which is sort of like a combination of a priest and an astrologer. So they're trained as well to determine when is the right time to perform a ritual, and then they become family priests. Basically, they perform the different samskaras, the different rites of passage for families, or other ceremonies such as inaugurating a house or the laying of brick for the first building and so on and so forth. So they become private priests. That's one option. The other option is to become a temple priest, which is another option. Then another one would be to become a teacher yourself and establish a school. And many also just after their school, their studies at the school, they decide to go completely different way and like try to get a job, say, in, an IT firm, right? Even though they have not necessarily had the training to do that, but they would, you know, do an additional year of study in, say, business management or whatnot, and then start a completely different career. I would say the most common would be to become a house priest.
One quick question regarding these priests that become jyotishis, as you say, astrologers. We mean electional astrology, muhurta. So they use their astrological training to elect the right time for rituals, correct? Or do you also mean that they do jataka in terms of, well, this is your life, this is your destiny type thing?
Well, they might do both depending on their inclination. When I say jyotishi, or the use of jyotisha is mostly in the sense that someone has an issue in their life or wants to accomplish something, and they will go to them, and then they will determine the remedy or the solution for that. So, for example, they'd say, okay, you need to perform this and this practice. For example, I don't know, recite this particular mantra and abstain from this particular food item, and perhaps, I don't know, sexual intercourse on this and this day, because this particular planet is, you know, troubling you or something, right? So or you should perform a yajna for a particular deity. Right, so they would sort of suggest different options and also depending on the means of the person in order to obtain the desired result.
Would you say that such priests or priests in training, would you say that they are fairly sheltered from modern culture, or that they have a dual citizenship and they sort of have this outer worldly side and this other inner Vedic training side?
I'd say it's both in a way, right? So there's always an effort. If you read the book, there's a conscious effort, especially from the teachers, to shield students from distractions from the outer world and from modernity in particular. So, for example, they will not allow them to go out of the school and interact with other people unless it's work related or studies related. They will try to minimize, for example, media consumption, such as movies, or for those who have access to the internet, basically, you know, to minimize the use of technology to access potentially distracting media, and so on and so forth. And on the other hand, they also try to be relevant citizens of India, and most of them are really aware of the difficulty of negotiating, you know, being in the world, in this modern world, and at the same time sort of preserving their ancient knowledge. And so it's a tension that's always there. But in the case of technology, on the one hand, they will try, for example, to minimize the students from watching TV or, you know, streaming YouTube or whatever. And on the other hand, they will use technology for their advantage. For example, they will use recorders or phones to record their recitation and play that back as a way of a tool to basically to study or to preserve or document certain rituals and practices. So there, it's not about just technology per se or the modern world per se, but sort of negotiating how to preserve tradition and the purity of the tradition, while at the same time using the advantages of modern world, basically.
Yeah, the tension is quite profound. May I share a story with you?
Please.
Actually, I'm currently based in Toronto, and just about an hour north of Toronto, there's a suburb called Richmond Hill. There is the Richmond Hill Hindu Temple, which, if I'm not mistaken, is the largest Hindu temple in North America. Currently, South Indian Tamil founding. Most of the congregation there is a South Indian Tamil-speaking Hindus. I visit the temple fairly regularly. What's interesting is that I come from the West Indies, and my ancestors are North Indian, so I don't speak a lick of any of the vernaculars there. So I have this, there's this barrier when it comes to language or dress or even food or caste. And they're very welcoming there. It's just that I'm from a very different texture than they are. However, with the Sanskrit and the ritual and the bhakti elements, I can identify right away. Now, in recent visits there, I've noticed that a couple of the priests that work there, their sons are in training. They're Brahmin-born, Toronto-born Brahmins who've undergone the Upanayana, their sacred thread. And you see these young boys who are as Canadian can be there. They're children of the West, of the modern age, and they are engaged in training with their fathers in a way that you wouldn't even know what century you're in when you're watching them. And if there was ever a project I'd want to do, you see, I'm a textual scholar. So I have no regrets. I love decoding Purana, decoding mythology. I love it. However, I was naive as an undergrad. I didn't even realize that one can get credit for interviewing people. learning about life and being a natural extrovert, that's what I did when I was distracting myself from my studies, and studies was always textual in my mind. So it never occurred to me that ethnography, that conversation could be a medium for scholarship at that point. I have no regrets, but if I was to do an ethnographic project, I would interview the young men at the Richmond Hill Hindu Temple and sort of dig into what must be I don't want to impose my categories on what their experience, but I imagine it would be a dual citizenship, and maybe at times maybe even jarring going from one milieu to the next, because they're also enrolled in public school in Toronto by day. So wow. It would be fascinating to understand this tension. So I just, this as I was reading your book, these young men came to mind. I thought this is really fascinating to see how this would even work in traditional Vedic training in Toronto out of the Gurukula. Now, for our listeners, thank you for indulging the story. For our listeners, why don't you tell them a little bit about this idea of the Gurukula, and very specifically a very, very important concept, the Guru-Shishya Sambandha. So I guess you'd say that the teacher-disciple relationship. This is of profound importance, the cornerstone for the transmission of Vedic texts. And I think it is something that's worth unpacking for our listeners.
Yes, indeed, it's one of the I would say one of the most important chapters in the book on how basically a student becomes a teacher, right? By learning to embody. The Veda in a way that basically is mirroring the teacher, right? So the Gurukula, the word Gurukula actually means the guru's house, or the guru's household or entourage. And so the transmission of the Veda happened since time immemorial, basically, through this transmission between father and son. This was the traditional way, was father and son. If we take the scriptures as historical documents in a way, right? And so the transmission was within this household, in which you would basically not just learn from the mouth of your father or your guru in this case, but you would also basically do anything that was required of you in the household. So it was not just about learning the text, right? It was learning how to be, a Brahmana, Vaidika, which included, fetching water or feeding the cows or learning how to talk to people. So all of this is I would say, very, very important in this tradition to basically become or acquire this identity. And this is still very relevant today. The model of guru and disciple, and the whole surrender of one's identity as an individual for this ideal of becoming the embodiment of the Veda. There's a lot to say about what it means to be a teacher and a disciple in this context, but I would say that it is definitely at the core of this transmission, right? The whole Vedic mantras and the whole recitation lies in this particular relationship, and it's a very intimate pedagogical model, so to speak, in which you basically become your teacher. That's the whole aim, to become your guru. And before that happens, there's a complete surrender to that person. And you can have more than one guru, of course, but in the sense of you are disciple to this teacher who is not just teaching you how to recite, but also is like a father figure, right? He is your model, basically, to emulate.
So, is it the disciple's prerogative to emulate the guru, become the guru, as you speak, insofar as the guru is Vedamurti? Is that the idea that the student's job is to emulate the teacher who, insofar as teacher embodies the Vedas, or is it beyond that?
Yes, I mean, I guess that's because the guru is seen as basically the accomplishment of and the embodiment, or say a walking entity of these scriptures, of this knowledge, right? But it goes beyond just being the Vedas as a text, but also as a way of life. So there's a lot about the discourse is a lot about the Vedic way of life. To become a Vedika is therefore not just to know to perfectly reproduce the text, but also to behave and to act like a ideal Brahmana, right? So that of course implies many things beyond being able to be a very excellent reciter or a virtuoso in ritual, right? So it goes beyond that, for sure.
That definitely resonates. I think of the guru shishya relationship as not only the riverbed for the transmission of whatever, in this case the Vedas, but also that it's a transmission of a way of being, of a way of being in the world, of a way of relating to others. An important thing that you note is that there are certain observances and a certain standard of ethical conduct that the student is expected to adhere to. It's sort of backwards than I believe we're used to thinking of it, in that the conduct is required up front in order to even receive initiation, compared to, well, we go to the guru to learn how to abstain from alcohol or meat or sex or what have you. Have you come across this notion of sort of the yamas and niyamas, to use the yoga terminology, or have you come across tensions in terms of what's expected of the students in order to receive initiation?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's not so much about necessarily in order to receive initiation, but more like once you've had initiation, basically you have to raise the bar to meet the standard, right? And so there are a lot of we were talking about ritual purity before, and of course that relates to the yamas and niyamas, if you will, which are there's a long tradition of Dharma Shastra. And so in the Dharma Shastra texts, there is always a longer chapter on how the Vedic student, the Brahmacharin, should behave, and how he should behave in relation to his teacher. So all of this is has a long history of encodedness, or it has been encoded in this text from the time of the Dharma Sutras, basically, and the Dharma Shastric texts. And the question is, how do they negotiate that in modern India, right? So there are many ideals or many rules, if you will, that are stated in the Dharma Shastra texts that are followed in these schools, but some of them, you know, have started to change as well. And just to give you an example, in most Dharma Shastric texts, it is written that the brahmacharin, the student, should sleep on the floor, right? No mattress, no, just on the bare floor. And so in some schools, in one particular school that I visited, I saw that there were bunk beds in that school. And so I inquired, and the teacher that I asked the question to, he was a little embarrassed, you know, because he knew perhaps that this was sort of the expected from the tradition, but that they had, you know, basically accommodated that, and he basically said, oh, we didn't have the power to decide, the sponsor, right, the person who had sponsored the school decided to donate beds for the kids, and of course the donor didn't know that students were supposed to sleep on the bare floor, and therefore they were sleeping now in bunk beds. And this is just a perhaps a paradigmatic example of how things are sometimes, you know, tolerated, and certain changes that are clearly, you know, not to be, not meant to be in the classical text, but are not necessarily followed anymore, or sort of sometimes found ways in which to sort of circumvent that rule.
So this leads to another question that I had. That I wanted you to comment on. You touch on it in your conclusion. In your experience, in your research, to what extent do you encounter preservation of tradition versus innovation of tradition?
Right. So chapter 6 in my book is fully dedicated to discussing you know, modernity and tradition and innovation, and I've argued that. You know, this tension between trying to preserve the Vedas is certainly one aspect of continuity. You know, the tradition is being kept alive in as far as the actual text is preserved, as it has been preserved for many, many centuries. And I would say innovation, there are many ways in which one could look at innovation, mostly in relation to vernacular forms of Hinduism, right? So how are these Brahmins as Vaidikas, so to speak, embedded in this larger context of Maharashtrian Hinduism, right? So there's a lot of particularities, right? And there's a particular flavor to the Hinduism in which these schools are embedded. So there's the whole context of, say, Maharashtrian bhakti, or as we were saying, the actual technology that it comes with modernity, Facebook and whatnot. So there you can say that certain parts of the tradition are certainly or continue to be transmitted in the traditional way or orally, even though also texts have now been introduced or recordings, as I was mentioning earlier, but the result, so to speak, is still to, or the aim is still to memorize this vast body of sound and to be able to reproduce that flawlessly. However, there are many ways in which innovations are being done. For example, there is one of the sub chapters in chapter 6 looks at how a traditional Shrauta Yajna, which is this very old form of Vedic ritual, fire Vedic ritual, is sort of performed in contemporary India, and how that's really interesting, because this particular ritual was a Rajasuya, and the Rajasuya is basically the
consecration
ritual for a king, right? There are no kings in India anymore, so how do they justify that, and how do they perform that? So there's that particular section in the book talks about this particular ritual and the whole justification for the need of such a ritual, right? And who did they choose as their king, for example, which turned out to be actually a farmer from Rajasthan who claimed to have royal blood, not Rajasthan, but Madhya Pradesh, I believe. Anyway, so the point is how the certain rituals continue to be performed in today's India, right? And the tensions that arise from that. I think that's one of the things that fascinates me the most about this subject is the relationship between trying to preserve a particular tradition and what that means with this ideal of a Brahmin, right? The ideal Brahmin versus negotiating all the changes and challenges that one confronts in the modern world, right?
We're definitely in an age where tradition is being challenged like never before. I mean, tradition in general, as a concept in various religious traditions on the planet. And it'll be interesting to see how something as ancient and as perhaps faithful as Vedic transmission, Vedic recitation, it'll be interesting to see how it fares over the next century or so. I have a question about something you commented on just now and also earlier in the interview, in terms of this repertoire of utterance that the student is responsible for mastering. Our audience may not have a sense of why you're so impressed. Can you give us a sense of how vast this utterance would be?
Yes, well, of course, it depends on which shaka we're talking about, but any shaka, I mean, they could, just to give you an example, there is a particular ritual in which the whole corpus of one particular shaka is recited, or a particular the core of that corpus is recited, and I was able to witness such a recitation of the full shaka, basically, and that takes typically a week of almost uninterrupted recitation. So Brahmins would wake up early, perform a ritual, and then start with the recitation, and finish at sunset, right? And then the next morning they would continue that, and that lasts for about a week, about 7-8 days of, like, I don't know, 8-10 hours a day of reciting uninterruptedly. So that's quite a bit, quite a few hours of reciting from memory.
Well, it's astonishing. It's astonishing, and it's difficult to really get a sense. It's difficult enough to memorize a Shakespearean sonnet, for example,
exactly.
or even the lines of a play if you're an actor. I mean, I have found that difficult in past to memorize, and much less hours upon hours upon hours of virtual enunciation, of intonation, of utterance. I'm not sure if it's easier or more difficult. The fact that you're not cognizing what you're uttering. This is you as if a songbird learning a sophisticated piece. It's just sound. It's sound and energy and vibration. I don't know if it would be easier or harder. more difficult to not know what you're saying, but nevertheless, you can only imagine memorizing hours upon hours upon hours of anything with precise pitch. It's staggering. And unless someone actually has a taste of it, they would not understand why you were so awestruck that you were pulled to study this for 2 degrees now. So is there anything that, let's end with a general question in terms of, did anything really surprise you about your research? Did anything strike you? Did you encounter something that you really didn't expect that you want to share with us?
That's a good question. Let me think about that. Well, one of the things that really fascinated me was the example of the Veda Mandir, which is a temple in Nasik, in a town in Maharashtra. And there is a temple there dedicated to the Veda. It's called Veda Mandir. And there the Veda is represented as a huge sculpture of a book bound in a Western style. So that, like a book, the books that we know in the West. And it's made of marble. It's huge. And it has the letters, it has engraved in Devanagari one verse from the Rig Veda and the Gayatri Mantra. You know, it's being worshipped as Bhagavan Ved. It's a form of God. And so that was really surprising to me, because until then, you know, I had read Fritz Stahl where he, you know, writes, if there's one thing the Vedas are not, are books. And then I, you know, see this temple where I see the Vedas being represented as a book, right? As a Western bound book. And so that was something that surprised me. And so I've been also working a little bit on that for this book, but perhaps also for a future article, I'm might be working on that a little more. Yeah, that's just one example. But to be honest, I was awestruck every day during my field work for this book. So
sounds like quite the journey. So in addition to this bound Vedas murti at this temple, what is your current project? What are you researching at the moment?
Yes, well, I've actually moved away, so to speak, from the Vedic tradition in the last few years, and I've done a couple of different things, and I'm currently working on popular urban religion, and I'm particularly interested in the little shrines that we see on the street, wayside shrines. And so I've put together an edited volume, a special issue with a colleague of mine, Raphael Bois, in Paris. And I'm looking forward to actually writing my second book on, so to speak, street religion, quote unquote, in a particular neighborhood in Pune. And I'm basically looking at how material religion, space production or production of sacred space, and basically the display of religiosity in the public sphere, in the public space, is negotiated in Pune. That's my current project. Or one of my current projects, yes.
So you've gone from these ancient, esoteric, traditional utterances to the modern streets of Pune. This is quite
exactly.
This is quite the diversity of scholarship. So that's great. I believe we have taken more than enough of your time for one day. So I want to thank you for joining us for today's interview.
Oh, thank you for the invitation and for giving me a chance to revisit my own work it's been sitting on a shelf for the past 2 years, basically. And now it was a nice way of coming back to it.
It's our pleasure. By the time the book is out, we've moved on to the next project. I know the feeling well. Once again, for our listeners, we have been speaking with Dr. Borayin Larios, who is assistant professor at the Institute for South Asian, Tibetan, and Buddhist Studies in Vienna. We've been talking with him about his open access book, Embodying the Vedas, Traditional Vedic Schools of Contemporary Maharashtra. Thanks very much. And to our listeners, until next time, keep reading. Take care.